thank Senator Williams. And I've known Senator Williams for many years because in the introduction, Ryan mentioned that I served one term in the Senate from 91 to 94 and served there with Senator Williams there. Ryan also mentioned I'm from Bedford, and Bedford is, if most people don't know, is just east of here, about 30, it takes me about 45 minutes to get downtown. So my wife and my family, I have a son at the University of Louisville in graduate school there, so we spend a lot of time here in Louisville. But you know, I grew up in a rural area in a small town like a lot of Kentuckians, probably like a lot of you all, and Bedford's no different than that. We're a one-stoplight town, and it's a great place to live. It's a great place to raise a family. It's a little tough business-wise up there sometimes, but I always like to give people a flavor of what rural life is like. And in Bedford, I could tell you a lot of stories, but I'll tell you just one, and it's a true story. They're always better when they're true. And a few years ago, a prominent family that lived there in Bedford for a long time, the Colberts, owned a lot of land and had a lot of property, but they didn't have any children as they aged. And Mr. Colbert passed away, and Miss Colbert got older in her 90s and decided to move to Indianapolis to live with her niece. And so she moved there, and she had one piece of property left in Bedford right behind the high school in Trimble County. She decided to sell it. So she came down just about a year and a half ago to sell her property, and she did. And she went to the county clerk's office to transfer the property, and she told her county clerk, Jerry Powell, she said, Jerry, you know, I've lived in Bedford all my life, and not much changes here. So it's basically almost the same as I always remembered it. And he said, well, you know, that's right, Gladys. It hasn't changed much here. It's been about the same for as long as I can remember, too. But he said, you know, we have a subway in Bedford now. And she looked at him, and she said, no kidding. Where's it start and where's it end? So, and I like to tell my friends in Newcastle that they don't have a subway, so we're a little bit ahead of them. As most of you know, our session began actually last Monday, and we spent 4 days in the House electing our leadership, electing Greg Stumbo to a second term of Speaker of the House, and he sends his regrets for not being able to be here today. And then we break, and traditionally our organizational session is set aside just for that, to elect our leadership, get our committee assignments, for new members to find their way around, to move into their offices, and those type of changes. And then on February 1st, we will begin what we refer to as our short session, our off-year session that lasts 30 legislative days. That session is normally set aside for us to monitor budget activity, to make adjustments to the budget, or we've used that short session during those times to do those type of things and to work on issues that we have debated and had hearings on through the interim and worked on during this interim period or in past sessions. And in the House, we will probably continue that tradition. We feel that that budget session or the short session is designed primarily for those type of issues. We will have to make some tweaking to our budget during this time in regard to Medicaid and in regard to higher education, where we're going to have to make some adjustments. And we will continue to monitor our budget. Now, most of you have seen probably or read in the paper or have heard reports that that we're doing better, that our revenue is coming in a little bit ahead of projection, and that is true through the first 6 months. It is. But it's a very, very fragile time for our economy and for our state budget, and so we're going to be very, very careful of anything that we might do in terms of the budget during this upcoming session. As a matter of fact, our intention in the House are to do very little outside of the adjustment to Medicaid and higher education that we need to do. One reason that we're careful with our budget is because our budget was designed in this first year of the fiscal year that we're halfway through, that we would build up a reserve that we could pass through to the second year to help balance our budget, and our budget is balanced through the two fiscal years. Because most of the stimulus money that we have relied on to balance our budget over these past 2 years will run out at the end of 2011, so we had to have additional revenue. And it's good that we are seeing our coffers fill up and our revenue coming in ahead of what we had projected. But at the same time, we have to be very careful because we have zero margin for effort. We have budgeted all of our budget reserve during this budget cycle, and so we have to be very careful and very cautious how we proceed with the budget. In the upcoming session, I think you'll see us work on Medicaid issues in the House. The governor has proposed a managed Medicaid approach to several parts of the Medicaid system that I think we'll work with the Governor Beshear on to see that we can try to accomplish those. I think other states have gone in their Medicaid budget and find ways to better ways to manage portions of the Medicaid budget. And I think you'll find that we will continue to work on that and work with the governor to bring that to fruition. We think we can save money. We think other states have proven areas that we can save money in Medicaid through managed care. And I think you'll see us continue to work on that. One thing that Speaker Stumbo has filed a bill named the False Claims Act. Many states now are being much more aggressive in trying to track down waste, fraud, and abuse, not just in Medicaid, but all over state government. Many states now have statutes in place that allow private individuals or government employees that report waste and abuse, that they can actually pursue those and actually at some point maybe collect part of the savings as their reward for bringing forth this type of abuse and waste that we find in state government. State government is a large entity, and it's very, very difficult to monitor and enforce all of the laws and to manage all of that. And the more eyes and ears that I think that we have on the ground and working with us will just make the delivery of the services that we have that much better. Over the past several months, a legislative committee a joint committee of both the House and the Senate have been examining our penal code. One of the fastest growing areas of our budget in Kentucky is corrections, nearly $500 million a year. And we have one of the fastest growing prison populations in the United States. We think that's something that we need to be a little bit smarter about. I think that I've heard people say the best way to look at corrections is that you have to deal with the people you are afraid of and the people you are mad at differently. It is very, very expensive to keep people in our prisons, but at the same time, we want our public safe. And hopefully, in working with the Pew Institute on the states, that they are going to bring forth a proposal, that this working group will bring forth a proposal that we can consider during this session to look at our penal code to help reduce our prison population, to deal with people who have problems, deal with them in different ways other than just incarceration. One other bill that we have worked on that will be a prominent piece of our agenda in the House is the E-Verify bill in terms of illegal immigrants. One of the, a problem in illegal immigration, there is no doubt is it a problem in our state and in the United States. And we, over the past two sessions in the House, have passed an E-Verify bill that has not made it out of the Senate, that would require any entity doing business with the state to verify who the people are working with them and verify that, in fact, they are here legally. And we intend to pass the E-Verify bill out of the House again and send it to the Senate. We also will pass again to raise the dropout age from 16 to 18 for our public schools. We think it's important to be the policy of this state that education is important, and in order to give students every opportunity to obtain that education and to remain in school as long as they can. Now, let's not, I don't want to dance around anything. I mean, one of the big issues during our session is going to be the gubernatorial election. There's no secret about that. It's going to be a factor in our, and I'm not saying it's going to be a negative factor. We don't know, but obviously, it'll be a factor, and it's going to be incumbent on us, I think, to in the House to work with Senator Williams as much as we can to help push forward an agenda that will help continue to move Kentucky forward. I think we've been able to do that over the last couple of years, or at least as long as I've been in this position. And hopefully we'll continue to do that in the future. I thank you all again for having me here.
And now the other member of our esteemed panel is, of course, Republican Senate President David Williams. He's had that position for 11 years as Senate President. He was first elected to the state legislature in 1994 in the House, and then 2 years later won an open state Senate seat, which he has represented since then. It's the 16th district, and it covers six counties across the Tennessee and Kentucky border. He is a University of Kentucky graduate and a University of Louisville Law School graduate. He's married to Judge Robin Williams, and together they are raising two children. And just in case he fails to mention this, he is running for the Republican nomination for governor this year. Senator President David Williams.
Thank you very much. As a matter of fact, I wasn't going to mention it. Chairman Rand, it's a pleasure to be here at the Louisville Forum. Had an opportunity to shake hands with many friends, a few people who don't know me, and some of you who have assumed that you know me, but might not know me as well as you will, probably. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I want to tell you how much I've enjoyed working with Chairman Rand. He's indeed one of the best legislators in the Kentucky House of Representatives, but, you know, Chairman Rand, that's kind of like someone told me that I was one of the brightest members of the Kentucky State Senate, and I thought they were going to compliment me, but they said, but, you know, then the bar is set pretty low. But Chairman Rand does a great job. He has probably one of the most difficult jobs in the legislature. I served in the House for 2 years, and the House is an unwieldy sort of body. There are a lot of things going on in the House. 100 members, all of them think they ought to be chairman of the Appropriation and Revenue Committee, only because they couldn't be speaker. Well, they really think they all ought to be speaker, you know. And so it's great, and we've had a great working relationship, and I look forward to continue doing that, Chairman Rand. And I'm really pleased that I almost heard, I guess I could have taken it, I won't take it out of context, but it said that you agreed that we would work on an agenda, and I would assume that agenda would include the 12 bills that we passed out of the Kentucky State Senate last week. But I won't ask you to make a commitment on all of those right now, because I'm sure that we'll have an opportunity to talk about those over the next several weeks. I want to just tell you, I never come to downtown Louisville in the winter that I don't remember. I just can't keep from remembering when I was a small child, and yes, I was small and a child at one time. My mother and my late father would come to Louisville every summer. We lived in Louisville, but then we came to Louisville quite frequently in the winter to visit my relatives. Most of my dad's siblings moved to Louisville after World War II. One of them was assistant superintendent of schools at Fort Knox, and one of them worked in the VA here, and they had several positions in DuPont and other places. But in the winter, in particular, I remember as a small child staying down in our relative's home down on Dixie Highway, and my mom and I would catch a bus to come downtown to go to Stewart's and 4th Street, see Santa Claus and everything, you know. And I will never forget the wind blowing up these streets here, you know, how cold it was. And how I couldn't tell my mom how cold it was, because everybody, no inside malls at the time. You know, Dixie Manor looked like Mall of America to me when I went up there, you know. And how cold it was, and getting chapped walking down through here. But what a wonderful place. 4th Street was really live then, you know. And I could go down through, I see some of the folks that here would remember 4th Street as it was then. What a great place it is. But I remember those days and my connection to the city of Louisville. My dad was an educator. His brother was assistant superintendent of schools at Fort Knox and lived in Valley, pardon me, and drove quite frequently down there. And we'd move up for the summer because my dad could make more money roofing houses here in Louisville in the VA houses that were being built than he could be in a principal or coach or math teacher down the country. And so I got to know Louisville really well at a young age, and always had felt very connected to Louisville. I came to the University of Louisville Law School, and Met a lot of people that practice here today. I felt it was very important to be exposed not only to the University of Kentucky, but to the University of Louisville. Excuse me just for a second. I'm in a situation here. And I, to the surprise of many of my friends, made it through the first year of law school at the University of Louisville. And then a mayoral race happened. The late Russ Maple was a Republican at that juncture in his life, and a new guy named Mitch McConnell was running for county judge. So Russ asked me to manage his mayoral campaign, and that's when I really got to know Louisville, the old city environs of Louisville. So we had an aldermanic slate. I managed Russ's campaign. Our headquarters was in the Habern Building, and we also had a headquarters at 26 and Dumanil. And I went to 26 and Dumanil the other day, and there's a child care center there in the same building where we had our headquarters there. And we had a lot of folks that were on the slate then. Meg Leibson, some of you might remember Meg Leibson, was a candidate for alderman. Coach Graves was a candidate for alderman then. Reverend R.R. Martin. Dr. Pope, who was had a lot of great... A lot of great candidates, and I got to know Louisville and the difference between Germantown and Schnitzelburg, the all-wool and yard-wide Democrat club, and a strangely named Republican club called the Loyal Republican Club was on Goss Avenue. Then I didn't know whether there was a disloyal Republican club also down the street there, but I have come to know Louisville in my formative years and during my years here, and it's always a pleasure. You know, as you go around the state, Rick, you might know that lines of referral from different urban areas happen. And in my particular area, Louisville is where people come to shop. Even though we're on the Tennessee line, we come to shop and for our healthcare services and our legal referrals all come to Louisville. So I've had a long relationship with Louisville and feel very much at home here, and have really enjoyed my relationship down through the years and the years that I lived here. Now, I want to talk to you just for a second about the relationship between urban and rural areas, and I want to talk to you about this legislative session a little bit. Now, if you look at the great societies that you remember, the cultures around the world, you know, you remember Rome, and when you think about Rome, you got to realize that everyone that made Rome a great culture didn't live in the city. The great legions weren't raised there. A lot of people quarried the rock. A lot of people raised the food. A lot of people looked at the urban center to provide services even then. If you look at the Jewish culture, Jerusalem was the center, and you had all the other environs around there. So there's a very close and important relationship between urban and rural areas. And many times people think, those of us that actually reside in rural areas, are not cognizant or informed about what goes on in the urban areas. But, you know, there's an important relationship. There are those that always try to drive the wedges between us. But for Kentucky to survive and to prosper, urban and rural Kentuckians must work together in a very close way. Because if you took the rural people out of the hospitals, out of the malls, out of the various other business places, Louisville would not be the prosperous place that it is right now. And on the other hand, if you took the great services, the medical services and the legal services and the other things that this urban area provides to the rest of the state, we could not prosper either. So it's always a pleasure for me to have an opportunity to come to Louisville. I'm here frequently. And since I've been the president of the state senate for 11 years, I come here frequently, and a great number of the members, obviously the Kentucky State Senate, I think there are 10 state senators who have at least part of their districts in Jefferson County right now. Now, we don't know after the redistricting what that might do. But I will tell you without fear of contradiction that the health of Louisville is crucial to the Commonwealth of Kentucky, just as the health of Lexington and Northern Kentucky and urban centers. We realize that those areas are the economic engine of the state of Kentucky. Likewise, the health of the rural areas is very important. So we try to strike a balance as we take a look at what we're going to do in the future of the Commonwealth. And as a matter of fact, this afternoon, I'm going to have an opportunity to go over and meet with your new mayor. He invited me to come over, and I'm going to have a meeting with him, and I look forward to that very much. I had a great working relationship over the 11 years that I've served as president of the Senate with Mayor Abramson, and we've met on many topics concerning the city of Louisville. And I look forward to developing a relationship, and I'm going to meet with some of the members of the Metro Council. I remember when the Metro Council was initially elected, one of the first things they did, many of them came over and met with me in Frankfort, and we had a tremendous meeting to open the door and as fellow legislators. This session of the General Assembly is called by some the short session. It's been called the organizational session. It can be referred to as many things, but when the session is over, I hope that we'll refer to it as the productive session. I hope that the House and the Senate can continue to work well together, and Speaker Stumbo, who is not here today but is ably represented by Chairman Rand, and I have a good working relationship. We followed some of the same paths. We're both from rural Kentucky. We went to the University of Kentucky and both graduated from the Brandeis School at the University of Louisville. We've worked well together. Now, you don't read a lot about when we work well together. I mean, you know, it's just kind of like in most situations, you hear about car wrecks or train wrecks or crashes. But when we work well together, and we have over the last couple of years since he's been speaker, you don't hear much about it. But we were faced with a dilemma when this last budget came to us. The governor presented a budget that was predicated on $1 billion that did not exist. About $450 million of that came from taking the Keys Scholarship money, which is actually money that comes from the lottery, taking all that money back out of there, putting it in the general fund, and bonding that $450 million for current expenses. Now, nobody thought that was a very good idea. And about $500 million in his budget that he presented came from license fees off slot machines over the next 5 years. Of course, he didn't advance any bills to put slot machines anywhere for the next 5 years or the last 5 years, nor offer any legislation. So Chairman Rand in the House was presented with a situation of starting off with about $950 million in the budget. And as the Speaker at the time said, they immediately threw the governor's budget in the trash can and started working on their own budget. And the House is a very difficult group to manage because there's so many folks in the House. And actually, I felt like they did a pretty tremendous job. Now, we ended up disagreeing on some things last time between the House and the Senate. We didn't agree on the $300 million of additional taxes that the House proposed because we felt like that they were ill-timed and probably ill-conceived, but well-intended. For example, they didn't want to allow business to carry their loss carryover, and they wanted to advance the payment of the sales tax. And at this particular juncture, lack of working capital is a real problem in most businesses in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and we just didn't think that was the thing to do at this particular juncture. In addition to that, they had about $1 billion of additional capital construction that they wanted to do, and we felt because our income had kind of leveled off that it was not the thing to do because of our debt ratio to increase that a much additional spending. So we didn't agree on that, and we almost came to an accord on the budget. We sent over to the House in the last day or so of the session a conference committee report that had been signed by all the Republican leadership in the Senate, all the Democratic leadership in the Senate, and all the Republican leadership in the House. And I will tell you that the Speaker and Chairman Rand made an attempt, I believe, to get a budget in a timely situation. And when we came back in the special session, we didn't have the $300 million worth of taxes, we didn't have the $1 billion worth of additional projects, and we did have virtually the identical budget that we sent over there. Now, I'm not blaming anybody, but I do think that the budget we end up having is a better budget than the governor presented, or a better budget than we could have had we not taken the action that we did. So we find ourselves in a situation now where virtually over the last 3 years or so, because of the ARRA or the stimulus money or the Obama bucks or whatever you want to call them. We have not, we have lived outside of the means of the Commonwealth of Kentucky as our taxes and revenue went down. And there is a day of reckoning coming. We've made some cuts, but not significant cuts, not as significant cuts as have been proposed in the Senate. And in this short session of the General Assembly, the governor is going to propose two additional cuts. One of them is a Medicaid cut, and is a very unfortunate situation because the governor said that he could cut $100 million or $125 million through various efficiencies in Medicaid, and he failed to do that. Okay, I'll finish up here in a second. So the other amount of money that we have involved is higher education money. So we don't know that we'll be able to come to accord on that. But the Senate was, and I'll go down through a list of bills that we passed. We passed Senate Bill 1, an independent tax commission that would write a new tax code for the Commonwealth of Kentucky, both at the state and local level. It's my considered experience. That's the only way we're going to get the tax changes that we need. We passed a pension reform bill that would take the state to a defined contribution plan for new employees instead of a defined benefit plan like everyone else in the private system. And there was a bill, Senate Bill 3, which some of you might have heard about, that had to do with voluntary charter schools and neighborhood schools and addressed school student assignment. We had a public accountability bill, which had to do with having the filing deadline for the General Assembly to take place after the General Assembly is over, so all of you might know how your legislators perform. We had an immigration bill that dealt in a different way than Chairman Rand talked about immigration, and I'll be glad to answer questions like that. We had a financial disclosure bill, a one-stop business situation so that any business can get on the internet and go to one location that wants to locate in Kentucky, an informed consent bill, which was a pro-life bill, Medicaid false claims, which Chairman Rand talked about, principal selection, and an advanced placement bill, which would include merit pay for teachers who recruited minority students or other non-traditional students to take advanced placement classes. So we feel like we have an agenda in this session of the General Assembly. We can work together collectively, and we hope we have a very productive session, and it won't be referred to when it's over as the short session, but as the productive session. Thank you very much.
Okay, now we'll do the fun part of the session. Kevin, you want to start us?
Yes, sir. We had quite a few questions come in. We could actually probably fill a book up, but I think that they mainly focus on about four or five different topics, which we're going to try and hit on here. The first one, the most recent, is involved around the shootings in Tucson, and wanted to know if we should consider proposed regulation on gun control.
Representative Rand, you want to start with that?
The short answer is in my judgment, no. I think we have to take into consideration, that the gentleman who shot the congresswoman and the people out there was mentally disturbed. I think we would be far better off concentrating on that. I saw a letter that Dr. Howard Bracco, it was emailed to me, and I think may have been in today's Courier Journal, where he talked about the way we communicate about people with mental illnesses, how little attention we give to them early on in terms of identifying people with mental illnesses and how we deal with them. So I think the short answer is I don't think you'll see significant changes to Kentucky's gun laws or federal gun laws in the near future.
Senator Williams, do you agree with that?
The accused passed a background check when he bought this 9mm weapon. And I think that's very unfortunate that he passed the background check because, the bottom line of it is there were enough indications there that some action should have been taken immediately to report his schizophrenia and the sorts of activity that he was involved in. The police had already visited his parents' home at least one time. And with instantaneous information like we have right now, that should absolutely happen. And so I believe that we have the ability to go anywhere in the world and take our credit card and buy anything that we want to buy. But when these sort of indications, normal people do not say the sort of things that this guy was doing, or don't act the way he was doing. And it had gotten to the point where the folks at the community college had done actually had their police officers make visits there. That information should have been entered, and there also should have been some action taken as far as a mental inquest situation, because students were already moving away from this guy in the classroom there. And the other thing that I would say along those lines is that in order to implement these sort of things, people have to take seriously. I lost one of my dearest and best friends to an assassination. He was a public official. And someone did a home entry on him and killed him in his home. And there was every indication there that this was a dangerous individual. And some things that you can't stop. But at least you put someone in the system and don't allow them to have access to those. And then when they're captured, do what they're doing now. Be very careful about the investigation, prosecution of those individuals, and take them off the street forever.
Senator, real quick, just to be clear, are you saying that the background check should be tightened, or are you saying that they should have been executed?
Well, I think the background check is sufficient. The information has to be input. People, all of us have to be sensitive. I've been involved as a defense attorney for most of my adult life, and I've represented people and protected their constitutional rights. But normal people do not threaten to kill. Normal people do not make the sort of statements this guy was making over the internet. And all of us have to be on guard to report those sort of activities and take them very seriously. I've had in my own life, and I won't go into it here, but we've had serious security situations, and when someone calls and threatens my life or threatens another member of the General Assembly, we take it very seriously, and we report it, we contact, and we input the information.
Okay, Lori?
There were several questions about education, so we'll start with the raising of the dropout age. So one questioner asks, why do you believe that extending the age will create students that we prepare to compete in the marketplace? Another one asks the other side of the coin. It seems like so obvious given our need to provide an educated workforce to prospective employers. So what is the strongest argument for maintaining the current age?
Okay, since Representative Rand, you brought up raising the age, why don't you start with that?
Well, I think it's very difficult for someone 16 years of age to know the full magnitude of their decisions when they drop out of school. I think many of them, and let's face it, many times parents aren't as involved as they should be with those students, but I'm not sure they have the capacity to understand like someone at my age and know that you just can't hardly make it in this world without a high school education, and it's getting more difficult without. And I think the longer we keep them in school, the more likely they're able to find a teacher who will mentor them, or they're more likely to find someone who will continue to encourage them, or find a path for them to be a successful person, because many times that's all it takes. It just takes one person to show an interest in a young person's life, to give them some direction and to help them move forward in a positive way. And I think that's the strongest argument for keep them in school till they're 18.
President Williams, what's your stance on that issue?
Well, the Jefferson County Public School system has the lowest graduation rate in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. The graduation rate in the Jefferson County Public School System is 71%, a hair over 71%. Now, that means that about 30% of the kids in the school system here, are not graduating. Now, the question is, if you kept them there for two more years at age 17 and 18, what difference would that make? What are you going to do with them? The larger problem is, how did you get there? How did you get to the point where 30% of the kids want to disassociate with education? So while raising the dropout rate in and of itself should not be that objectionable, to do it immediately without places to put these young people or without a plan to put them there seems to me, what are you going to do with the kids? The alternative schools you have, the sorts of things, there is just not a preparation. I think that when you get these kids, you ought to have some ability for these young people to do online sort of preparation for a qualification as far as doing a GED sort of test? I mean, if you get them there, how are you going to test them? What's their situation? It's a complex issue. And I've watched politicians come up and act, well, if we just change the speed limit sign here, you know, everybody's going, well, I mean, you got to do something about the enforcement. You got to do something about the public education of people as to the situation. So I don't think in and of itself it's a cure-all. I think that we have to address the larger issues in education, and that is how many young people that we're losing because they do not have proficiencies in math and reading primarily, and those kids are acting out and dropping out because they are not successful there, and they want to exit. Nobody can do, you just can't do very much with a 17 or almost an 18-year-old if they don't want to be there. So if you change the dropout date, you need to go back to about the sixth grade or something and raise those expectations, because a lot of these 14 and 15-year-olds are there. Now, I was the primary sponsor of the Adult Education Adult Literacy Bill, and we've come a long way in adult education and adult literacy in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And we need to focus on those students in that group, but the answer is not just a simplistic raising the dropout age and everything's gonna be like free bubble up and rainbow stew just because you change the dropout. You still got these kids that are behind.
So are you gonna vote no on that bill if it comes
to
the Senate?
If it makes it over here again, it will not pass the Kentucky State Senate unless there is a complete plan to determine what we're going to do with the students that are gonna remain in school, have a plan and fund those students and address some of the larger issues. I'm not a particularly hard opponent of it, but I just think it's a simplistic approach to a very difficult problem.
Okay. Lori?
Sticking with the topic of education, there's lots of questions in here about the proposed neighborhood schools bill. So one questioner asks, why do you think it's important to dictate policy to districts when there are a few areas in Kentucky that would have issues or large enough to need neighborhood schools, or for that to be an issue? Why should those decisions be made in Frankfort and not locally? And also, where would the funding come to build the additional schools required by that proposed bill?
Senator Williams, I'm pretty sure that was aimed at you.
Yeah. Well, the way that was posed reminds me of the question, do you still beat your wife? You know, I mean, it wasn't a very fair question, but it engages the issue, you know, engages the issue. The bottom line of it is the bill as proposed does not take away local control for student assignment from the Jefferson County Board of Education. What it does is it requires, and many people who have criticized this bill, what it does is require parents to be empowered to make decisions about where their children go to school. Now, diversity is an important and crucial goal to reach, and there are many ways that you can reach this goal, but the testimony over in front of the Education Committee on this particular bill indicated that there were 5,600 folks that weren't pleased, or at least came forward that weren't pleased with their student assignments, and they said just 2,800 of them didn't get to go to the school of their choice. There are all sorts of ways that you can move students around to get diversity. The larger issue that you have is, what about the parent? Should the parent be able to have any say? The General Assembly has always set out these sort of policies. The particular bill in question, or the law in question, said all along that students should be able to enroll their children in the school closest to them. But the court here ruled that enroll did not mean enroll for attendance at that particular school. So if someone will read the bill, this particular bill gives the Jefferson County Board of Education the right to set up attendance zones to accomplish those sort of things that the Supreme Court said you could do, but gives the parent some leverage to make sure that he or she can keep their child at a school proximate to their residence so they can be involved in the PTA, PTO, or so that they can have some sort of semblance of participation. These satellite units all across the county, 6% of the money in Jefferson County school system is spent on this transportation program, and I think that's an inordinate amount of money to spend on transportation where you have this concentration. The bottom line of it, this particular bill empowers parents and also includes voluntary charter schools that will allow another way to intervene into failing schools. 40% of the schools in Kentucky for 2 years in a row that were deemed failing schools are located here in Jefferson County. It's a crisis that we have as far as economic development. Mayor Abramson and I have been talking about this over the decade. In many large cities, you have a situation where the city governments and governing agencies actually are involved in running the education system. And I see one of my friends with the Jefferson County Teachers Association here. With all due respect, this school board here is owned and run by the Jefferson County Teachers Association. They elect the people every time. Nobody else can get elected. And as long as that situation exists, there's not going to be very many good things happen. I mean, there have to be some changes here. This empowers parents to participate in the education of their own children.
Okay, Representative Rand, what are the House Democrats going to do with that bill?
Well, I don't know. I'm not on the education committee, but I would imagine it's going to get a good hearing.
That's good.
Yeah, that's right. It does take the authority away from the Jefferson County Board of Education, in my opinion. If they came to Trimble County, where I live, and did that, that's exactly what I would think. That they were taking away power from my local board, my local representative there. Now, it's hard for me to imagine what people in Jefferson County have to go through, because Trimble County has 1,500 students K through 12, and the school is the center of our community. It's where people go. It's what we rally around in small communities, and I know that's different in Jefferson County. My son's, as I mentioned, is a graduate student at University of Louisville. He's working with the Kentucky Department of Education while he's a graduate student at Shawnee High School, which has been quite a cultural shock for him, because one of his jobs is to read questions to students who are freshmen in high school that can't read and write, and write their answers, and it's been quite a shock for him. So there are problems, and not just unique to Jefferson County, but my concerns and questions are, is what are the costs going to be? Are we going to have pockets of impoverished areas in Jefferson County that cannot afford to support a school like we have in rural Kentucky, and we have those places in rural Kentucky now? Are we just going to create those type of pockets here in Jefferson County, those poor areas are just going to be pushed aside? That's not what we should be about. That's not what the Kentucky Education Reform Act was about. And I would imagine we would take a good look at that bill. I would imagine it's going to have tough sledding in the House. Would be
well. Let me respond to that. If you look at the schools that are in failure, that's where those schools already are. Those schools are in impoverished areas. For 40-something years, we've had in place a busing system with a laudable goal. But the bottom line of it is that if you are a minority or if you are socioeconomically disadvantaged, your test scores have not improved over 40 years. If you look at these dropout rates or the schools that are in crisis that are identified, Chairman Rand, the state government's already intervening. We have a bill that identifies those schools by test scores and goes in and does some fairly draconian sort of things. Tell them to fire half the teachers, remove the site-based council. You fire half the teachers, the Jefferson County Teachers Association gets to determine who goes back in there. You have a bunch of first-year teachers go in there in a difficult situation. So, I mean, this is a complex problem, but I remember the time when there were proud community schools in this area here. Now, you can still do the diversity by magnet schools and other things that work, but the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and the test scores show that you're still underserved, and it's primarily identified in isolated areas that are socioeconomically disadvantaged. And there's absolutely no proof, if you'll look at the minutes of the Jefferson County Board of Education meeting, Member Haddad says, we have no idea. Since you don't have any idea of what the budget is going to be, and this is in September 13th of 2010, talking about the transportation plan, they have no idea. But as soon as we try to tell them to do something about it, then they come up with specific ideas. That's just like telling people that there are 25 billion stars. They don't ask a question, but if you tell them if the paint is wet over on the bench, they want to touch it to see. And the bottom line of it is there's no logical explanation of why it would cost any more to let 2,800 parents, if that's the only ones that are dissatisfied, choose the school or at least have some authority to choose the school. It won't cost any more.
Let's go on to the next question. Kevin?
Thank you. Another topic that's receiving national attention, and we had a lot of views on both sides in our audience today, was on immigration. And could you give us some insight as to how our local legislation will vote on that?
Well, Senator Williams, you all already passed an immigration bill, but let's go to Chairman Rand. What do you expect? You mentioned the E-Verify bill. Start with that real briefly, and what do you expect the House to do with the immigration bill that the Senate passed?
Well, a lot of these bills, and although the issues have been out there for a long time, we read about them in the newspaper, we see them on television, think about them, but you don't think about them as a legislator, I think, until a bill's been filed. We just received that bill on Friday, and I think it was probably introduced maybe Monday or Tuesday to take a look at. This is not Arizona. This is not Arizona. We don't have the same immigration problems here that Arizona has. One thing that I've discovered about immigration is that, yes, when I'm out in my district, and I have a rural district, an agricultural district, that I have more people come to my office and say, Rick, if you take my labor away, I can't get my crops in. So I get both sides of it. And then I have people that come in, they're concerned about illegal immigration. Here in Jefferson County, one thing that I think would be a concern is if we pass a law like that, what kind of backlash would there be from conventioners and people who wanted to locate businesses here, from athletic teams who have in Arizona? I think the Arizona Diamondbacks have came out against the immigration law. And what are we going to do that? And beyond that, what do we, how do we deal with these people, because their labor's demanded. The market brings them here. We don't send government buses down to bring them up or anything. They come here for work. That's why most of these immigrants are here. I know they are in my home county because I know many of them. I know many of them that have children. They go to school. They work. They do all they can. Now, to be here illegally is wrong. But how do you stop it? I don't think in Kentucky we can. And I think it would be wrong of us to pass a Arizona-style immigration bill. I think it would be terrible public relations for Kentucky, and it would be virtually impossible to enforce.
Senator Williams, why do the Republican senators want to pass an Arizona-style law, as Representative Rand referred to it?
Well, the approach that the House wants to choose is to be punitive toward folks that use immigrant labor and have them to have the entire responsibility of that. And it's a fairly typical response of folks in his party, and that is for those people that are not violating a crime in particular to take responsibility and to punish and be punitive toward businesses. But the bottom line of it is this. The immigration policy in the United States of America is a mess. We're in a situation right now where we continue, if we become a sanctuary state, if all these other states are passing these laws and we become a sanctuary state, we might not have as big a problem as Arizona does right now, but your mind would be changed a little bit if you were run over once by someone who didn't have a legal driver's license and therefore could not have insurance on their car, or if the jobs that were taken. The Democrat approach on this will push folks out into a cash economy and will take them completely out of the economy where they're paying any taxes or participating. Now, I'm not insensitive to the fact that we are a nation of immigrants, but we have a large number of illegal aliens that are here taking up social services, causing problems, and many of them do very positive things. I admire folks that take care of their families and work hard. And many of them send a large portion of their money back to Mexico to take care of their parents there. But we operate in the situation that we exist in now, And these immigrants are a serious problem as far as the Medicaid system, as far as unpaid health care, as far as strains on our education system. All of those things collectively cry out for addressing the immigration issue. And if the House has a better issue other than just try to be punitive to some business who might have made an attempt to validate someone's citizenship and fine them significantly, then we can sit down and talk about that. But something needs to be done to address the issue, and we've started the discussion, and we're willing to sit down in a bipartisan sort of way and continue this discussion.
Well, and let me just say what the House's position is. The House's position is we need to move slowly. We need to be measured. We need to study this and deliberate and debate. We're not a sanctuary state now. We probably never will be one. Why do we need to put a framework of laws in until it is needed?
Okay, I think this will be our last question. Lori?
Wouldn't want to do anything preventive in nature, for sure. But, as far as being in too big a hurry, you can stop the process.
All right, Senator, let's go to last question, Lori.
Okay, not surprisingly, there were several questions about taxes. What is the biggest obstacle to achieving tax modernization, and what needs to happen to move forward on passing it?
All right, Senator, since you all passed the tax process, why don't you explain?
The biggest problem that you have as far as tax reform in the Commonwealth of Kentucky is the lack of political will to do so, and the lack of expertise located in the Kentucky General Assembly. Now, I think I have some credential on being involved in risky activity as far as tax proposals are concerned. I voted for the Kentucky Education Reform Act at the recommendation of the business community in the state, most of whom commenced immediately on bailing out and taking their taxable side of somewhere else after we passed those laws, and cost us thousands of jobs. And we've rectified that over the last several years by lowering the corporate income tax from 8.75 to 6, lowering most personal income taxes, holding the level on property taxes. But the bottom line of it is we have a tax system that's out of sync, and a governor who has no interest in changing it, and a House that doesn't want to talk about it. So the Constitution says that this measure can only start in the House, and the only thing we can do in the Senate is try to come up with some structural approach to get that discussion started. Now, if there's anyone here in the crowd that thinks that our tax system in this state is not an impediment to economic growth and job creation, you just need to look at what this state does. We have all these incentive programs that we give out selectively, that the Economic Development Cabinet or the Tourism Cabinet picks the winners and losers. We never get to talk to all the people that don't even look at Kentucky at all. The other states are changing. Mitch Daniels has changed and will change Indiana. And if you think that won't have an effect on you, you just wait and see. Tennessee's tax codes, no personal income tax except for dividends and some interest, no corporate tax. We've made changes here, but we need big tax reform. The legislature is not politically able to do that now. Now, if they want to amend the Constitution and allow this to start in the state Senate, we'll change it. If they'll pass the bill that we create, we will change it. But people need to lead, follow, or get out of the way on this issue. And just to say that we need to wait forever and it's not time and we need to discuss it, I'll give you one example. Speaker Stumbo, this is short, Speaker Stumbo, my good friend, said that we need to do away with the corporate income tax and do an earned income credit. Well, both of those would blow holes in the budget, so those were nothing. And what did the governor do? He calls a press conference to remind people that they can file for their earned income credit on the federal law. Oh, by the way, a question was, are you for an earned income credit at the state level? Well, I'm for it, but we can't afford it right now. So, the decision is, do we create a tax system that will create jobs in the Commonwealth of Kentucky? Because if social programs could create wealth or change our country, we'd be living in utopia. We would live here already. So that's what we're willing to do. What are they willing to do except, instead of light the candle, to curse the darkness?
Chairman Rand, you get the last word.
Great.
That was it.
No, I get a little more than that. you know, the best piece of political advice that I have ever received in my career, in my life, when I was in the Senate, I had the good fortune of being seatmates with Joe Wright. He was state senator. Senator William knows him very well. He was the majority leader in the Senate then, and I was sitting next to him. I'd never been through a session, and bills were being voted on, and things were flying around. I didn't know what the heck was going on. And I asked Joe, I said, Joe, how will I know when I'm doing the right thing? He said, Rick, you won't have any trouble knowing when you're doing the right thing. The real question is, do you have the courage to do it? And I think that's where we are with tax reform. If we want tax reform, we have to have the courage in the Kentucky House and the Kentucky Senate to give that authority away for some up or down vote to a group of people because part of the problem with tax policy is not just, you know, the structure and how it's structured, but it's the political fallout from it too. Because ultimately the General Assembly has to pass it. Ultimately we have to make the votes on it. I think the bill that's proposed allows the Committee on Appropriations and Revenue to talk about it, but it says we must report it out. So we don't even really take a vote on it in our committee. My members aren't going to like that. They're elected. They're the leaders in their communities, and it won't work that way. We have to find the courage. We did once before, and to Senator Williams' credit, he was a leader in that when we did the Kentucky Education Reform Act. People rallied around a bill, around a concept, around something better in their future, and they decided to pay for it. They will do that again. People that I represent tell me all the time that, you know, if you give me a good reason to raise my taxes, I'll probably go along with it. If you give me no reason, then I probably won't. And we're not giving them a good reason right now. We're not advancing our education system. We're not improving our business climate. We're not doing any of those things. And until we do, people aren't gonna buy into it, whether some group proposes it for an up or down vote or we debate. Now, we debated. We had a tax reform working group in the House last session, led by Harry Moberly, my predecessor, who's a real heavyweight in terms of tax policy in the General Assembly. He's retired now. But that bipartisan group brought some reforms that we put in our budget. One was the suspension, not a tax increase, but a suspension of the net operating loss. That was crushed in the Senate. Crushed. Absolutely. It was absolutely crushed in the Senate. So until we have a coming together of House and Senate leaders with the attitude that we are going to work on this problem and that we are going to, together in a bipartisan effort, work on this issue, it's not going to pass.
All right, and thank you very much to our esteemed panel, and thanks for all the good questions.